Again, as I mentioned, the section verses 1 through 11 is somewhat parenthetical to the primary narrative beginning or ending in chapter 4 and verse 31 and getting in again into chapter 5 and verse 12, where we find the preaching of the apostles in Jerusalem at that time and the effect of the preaching as well as the miracles that were performed. In chapter 4, it was the healing of the lame man that caused Peter and John, who were in the temple at the gate called Beautiful, and healed him, to be arrested as the Sadducees disagreed with the teaching they were doing as they were proclaiming the resurrection, teaching concerning the resurrection using Jesus as the proof of that resurrection. Sadducees, of course, did not believe that there was such a thing as a resurrection, and as they held the chief places in the Sanhedrin, they were in a position of influence and sought to imprison Peter and John. And you'll remember that initially, though they warned them, they let them go. But they told them, "Do not proclaim anymore this word that you're teaching." And of course, the answer of Peter and John was that we cannot but help. We must preach the things that we have seen and heard. That's chapter 4 and verse 20. We cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. So immediately they continue to do it. And we find in verse 12 that narrative taken up and what happened as they continued doing exactly the same thing. So I would like you to read with me beginning in verse 12, going through verse 16. Of that fifth chapter, Acts 5, 12 through 16. "And through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done among the people, and they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. Yet none of the rest dared join them, but the people esteemed them highly. And believers were increasingly added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women, so that they brought the sick out into the streets and laid them on beds and couches, that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might fall on some of them. Also a multitude gathered from the surrounding cities to Jerusalem, bringing sick people and those who were tormented by unclean spirits, and they were all healed." Now, just want to note very quickly that verse 13 and 14 constitutes a somewhat difficult verse to understand. "None of the rest dare join them." Who is the rest? Who's the them? "But the people esteemed them highly." What's the contrast given there? And then finally, in verse 14, "the believers were increasingly added to the Lord." If none of the rest dared join them, how were believers increasingly added? And so it almost sounds, I wouldn't say it sounds necessarily contradictory, but it sounds somewhat confusing. And so an explanation of that text, a recognition that there are various explanations given, but I think the true explanation is fairly evident with a careful reading. But we want to make note of those things. And we want to start off by making note of the fact that miracles were being performed, signs and wonders. And in fact, in chapter 2 and in verse 22, Acts chapter 2 and verse 22, there is that prediction concerning those things. You'll notice the statement made there, "Men of Israel, hear these words of Jesus." A reference back to his ministry. "A man attested to God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs." There's two phrases again, signs and wonders, which God did through him in your midst, as you yourself also know. The two words, signs and wonders, are ones that we have already defined. It's kind of hard to define them because but the significance in the term itself, the sign, it has reference to an evidence. A sign is a signal or signification that these individuals had divine approval. The reason why miracles were performed in the first century was to signify to those who saw the miracles that they, the things that were being done, and more importantly, the things that were being said, had divine approval. And so that's the significance of the term sign. A wonder is something that elicits wonder. It elicits awe, perhaps fear in the heart of those who witness it. And so it is something that is obviously out of the ordinary. I was listening to Max Lucado on the internet yesterday evening, just for a few moments. It was very difficult for me to do. Many of you are aware of who Max Lucado is, purported for a long while to be a gospel preacher, though his teaching was very much heretical. And it's obvious to me in listening to this short section that he's become completely Calvinistic in his thinking. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. He talked about a miraculous swapping of the heart. He had reference to the fact that when Jesus, when we're converted, that Jesus, his heart takes the place of our heart. And it's no longer our heart, but his heart. Now, it's a distortion of what the Apostle Paul talked about when he said that it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me, having reference to the surrendering of the will. But that's not the position he was taking. He was saying that work of grace is something that basically changes an individual, and the heart is completely gone, and Christ's heart fills and takes its place, and it really peculiar thing. But I thought it was interesting in that statement that he used the word a miracle. It was a miraculous thing. He used the term miracle to refer to, in effect, the process of conversion. And I thought that was a peculiar thing. Now, Lucado fancies himself somewhat of a poet, so he speaks in poetical terms when, in fact, he ought to be more careful in his speech. But that's just his way, and one of the primary reasons, I suppose, that he's gone on into error. The term miracle has reference to the setting aside of what is natural. God has established laws, physical laws that govern the universe, and there have been times in the past where he has set aside those laws for his own purpose. Obviously possible, if he has created the universe, he certainly has the ability to suspend those laws that are in that universe for his purpose if he desires. And in the past he did, primarily, as we indicated here, in order to verify concerning those who had given that power that they were from him. But the ability to perform these signs and wonders elicits fear in the hearts of men. It's an amazing thing. It's one thing for me to be awed as I see the natural laws. We see the planets revolve and rotate. We see the flowers blooming, and we see the growth of a child into a man, and all of those things that are very natural. People who are very imprecise will sometimes talk about that as miracles, miraculous. You've heard many times the miracle of childbirth. Nothing miraculous about childbirth at all. It's an amazing and astounding thing, but it is natural. But when you're talking about miracles, you're talking about the setting aside of what is natural. And as such, because it is something that has not been seen before, it is obvious that it is something that is not natural at all. It elicits wonder in the hearts of men. And so that's the significance of the second term with regard to what was being accomplished. And so you can recognize and understand why the people, as they saw these things, while it might be said of them in verse 16, not 16, I'm not where I need to be, where it may be said concerning them in verse 13 that none of them dare join them, they nevertheless were enthralled by them and what was being accomplished at that time. Whoever the they is, and we'll discuss that in a moment. Yes, Kelly.
I just want to make a couple of points. Can't leave out the fact that the miracles were being done by the apostles.
Yeah.
And that's an important point to make there. The other thing is that when you're talking about the difference, and I've heard, you know, members of my family that says, you know, they talk about the miracle of childbirth, the miracle, a natural process. A miracle, as God defines it in His Word, is something that we can repeat on our own. It's not a repeatable process. Only God could do it. He used men's hands to do it, perhaps, but they couldn't repeat it in and of themselves. So, the apostles could not in and of themselves heal sick. They could not in and of themselves raise the dead. They didn't have that power in and of themselves. That was the power God gave them. So it's a non-repeatable process.
Well, if they did have that power in and of themselves, it could not be rightly considered a sign, not only a miracle, but a sign, because the sign or the reason why it is referred to there as a sign is it is an indication. It signifies that what these men were doing was indeed outside of themselves and outside of their power. It had to be from God. And that's why I thought that we'd make emphasis or emphasize that so that people would be aware of the significance of that term. I thought it also interesting to point out the fact that what is stated in verse 12, very, very similar to a phrase and passage that is used in Hebrews chapter 2. But I want you to recognize, again, the significance of the term sign in that these miracles that were performed by the apostles was an attestation or testimony from God himself as to their validity, the validity of what they were teaching and their standing as ambassadors of Christ. And so you'll notice the phrase that is used or the language that is used in verse 12, that through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done among the people. And you look in Hebrews chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4 and you see very similar language. We are told that we must give the more earnest heed to the things we have heard lest we drift away. For if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast and every transgression and disobedience received a just reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us, notice here, by those who heard him. So the word was confirmed to us by those who heard him. So Jesus spoke the word first. Those who heard him, they confirmed that word. So how is the word confirmed? Well, it is through the witness of God. God bears witness with, notice, signs and wonders. The same two words are used there. And that this is, again, an attestation or a bearing of witness on the part of God himself as to the things that Jesus first spoke and then those who heard him followed after and spoke as well. So God confirms it. God confirms it with the signs, wonders, various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit in accord with his will. This is how the word is confirmed and how we know it to be true and how we know it to be so. First established by Jesus, and again, the contrast here given is through the words which were spoken through the messengers in the past. The word angels there, and again, maybe a little bit misconstrued the meaning of the text. There's nothing inherent in the term angel to indicate a divine being. In other words, a being that the created beings that that serve as divine messengers in old times. They are certainly included in that. But he used men to be messengers as well. And the word angel simply has a reference to a messenger, whether it be one of the divine created beings that are referred to on numerous occasions in Scripture, or whether it be men. But in the past, when God spoke through various means, whether it be the divine messengers or the human messengers, the prophets, when he spoke, those things had to be heeded and obeyed. And so it is even more appropriate and important for us in this day when we have the words not of just those messengers, but of the Son himself, in that we know that it is the Son. We can be assured that these are, that Jesus was the Son of God and that what he was speaking was from God because God attested to that with the signs and wonders performed by the apostles. Since we know that that is the case, here is the significance of it. And by the way, this impacts the next section of our study. Since God has borne witness as to these things being from him, and these things being significant in that they were spoken by the Lord, there is a consequence to that understanding and recognition. And that is that if they indeed are from God, are from the Christ, the Anointed One, how shall we escape if we neglect the salvation? In other words, if we recognize that these words are authoritative, it is incumbent upon us as individuals who understand and recognize that to obey them. And I think that it's an interesting thing that you have a group of people, and this will just kind of segue into the next point of the lesson, as we continue to talk about the fact that none of the rest dared join them, that you have a group of individuals who were very much enthralled with what was going on. They were sitting there watching what was going on. You'll remember in the fourth chapter as we talked about what the apostles were doing, what Peter and John were doing. When they healed the lame man, people saw it and they couldn't deny. Even the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, couldn't deny that a notable miracle had been accomplished on that occasion, and yet they did not join them. They didn't become believers. Now some did, many did, multitudes did. But there were individuals who were enthralled by what was going on, recognized the divine origin of what was going on, and yet did not obey. And that is something that is, at one point, difficult to understand, but nevertheless is extremely common. And I don't know exactly if perhaps you have a better understanding of that mindset than do I, but when I see an individual who knows what is right, knows what is supposed to be done, knows what is required, recognizes it, and not only this, but also recognizes the benefits of doing it and the consequences of not doing it, and yet, with regard to especially these spiritual matters, decides not to do it. Makes the decision, enthralled by it, interested in it, but not willing to participate in it. It's a peculiar mindset that would lead to that. There are consequences to these things. If indeed, as we mentioned before, God has established with His signs and wonders the truthfulness of what this man by the name of Jesus spoke, the truthfulness of what those who were His ambassadors spoke, and He has, then how will we escape if we neglect what was preached, what was taught? If those things that were taught beforehand that were inferior, we were held to, then how are we going to escape when this great and final message is proclaimed? And the answer is, we will not. It's kind of a rhetorical question. How shall we escape? We won't escape. And so the significance of becoming obedient to that, that's the distinction, the difference. Some look at it, accept the veracity of it, and yet do not commit themselves. And they suffer the consequence of it. Because in truth, if you recognize it, accept the veracity of it, then it teaches, it establishes a truth, and that is you must obey it. Grace of God, which brings salvation, teaches us that we must deny ungodliness and live righteously and soberly. There are consequences to the recognition and acceptance of those things. Yes?
So just to touch off of our subject, but the word confirms, when God confirms something, there's no need to reconfirm it. And so when individuals today are arguing that we need, or that they have, if they don't, miraculous powers in order to produce faith, the miracles didn't produce faith. The miracles confirm the message. It's the message that produces faith.
Right.
And the message doesn't have to be reconfirmed.
Right.
And I think it's Galatians where Paul makes the statement, for an oath once established, no man can disannul it. Once it's been affirmed, well, when God affirmed His oath through the gospel, that doesn't have to be reaffirmed.
Right.
It's already been confirmed. And so the only thing one can have to have confirmation, if you will, of his standing before God is the previously confirmed message,
right,
not a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Okay, as we continue on, you'll notice that they met at Solomon's porch. One of the questions raised is, who is it that is the they there? In that particular context, I believe that the indication would be it's not simply referring to the apostles meeting there. Now, distinction is made, and rightfully so, as Kelly indicated, that those who are performing the miracles on that occasion, you'll notice in verse 12, it is through the hands of the apostles that those signs and wonders were being performed. But where it says that they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch, they were all, I think the reference would be to all the believers. And one of the reasons why I would say that is that it seems to parallel the phrase or the statements in Acts chapter 2, as we are told that they continue daily with one accord in the temple and in the breaking of bread from house to house. So there, and again, you'll see a parallel here to where we're told that they were at Solomon's porch each day, and then we are told a bit later that the individuals were, verse 13, the people esteemed them highly. In the next verse, I'm not sure exactly what happened there. I'm afraid that my lamp may have gone out. Something bad happened just then. Okay, so we're just going to have to go on without it. I think I heard a click. Did you hear a click just then? Well, you don't hear very well, though, do you, Richard? Sorry about that.
My wife said, "Don't talk to me. You can't hear me."
She heard it. Well, that pop's not a good thing because those are expensive lamps. But anyway, okay. Well, at the end of that, as we mentioned in verse 13 of the text, we're told that the people esteemed them highly, and that all were with one accord in Solomon's porch. And very similar to what is said in Acts 2, 46 and 47, that they continued daily with one accord in the temple in verse 47, that they praised God and had favor with all of the people. So this trend continues here in that we have a situation where you have the common people who were very pleased with what the disciples were doing and the preaching that was being done. But you have the leaders of the people that are very much upset with it. So keep in mind that contrast. Now, continuing on, I want you to notice in verse 13, and this is where we get into somewhat difficult, because it says, none of the rest dare join them. And some would say, for example, that because of the problems that were happening with the apostles in the preaching, that none of the other Christians would join the apostles in the preaching that was being done because of their, perhaps, fear of reprisal. I really don't think that that's what's under consideration here in this place. I want you to notice that there seems to be several groups that are involved in this particular section of Scripture. First of all, you've got the apostles and the brethren. And again, you'll see, as we saw in Acts chapter 2, the brethren were together in the temple. Again, the indication, latter part of verse 12, that they're all with one accord in Solomon's porch. But as we mentioned before, that there are many, many individuals who come to the temple. This was not the Christian center of worship. It was the Jewish center of worship. The Christians were, I suppose you could call them interlopers, because they were there. It was, in the mind of the Jews, a new sect that was being established. Everything was new. These were things that they had not seen before. And you can imagine, as the people, here were the Christians in Solomon's porch, and they were worshiping and they were praising God, and these miracles were being performed. You'll notice, going on in verses 14 through 16, that there were multitudes of individuals who were being healed. And so people were looking on and seeing this. And these people that looked on, they were amazed at what was going on, and yet they didn't themselves, they didn't join up. And it says that they were, none of the rest dared join them. There was esteem that was there, but there were many who were in a group that kind of stood off, and perhaps that fear. Think about Ananias and Sapphira. Just imagine for a moment. Here were individuals that were in this group of people, and they're struck dead. I don't want to be there. I don't want to be close to that type of situation, unless there was that degree of faith that was engendered in some in verse 14 that are referred to here as believers that were added. And some said added to them. Some translations indicated added to the Lord. The Greek actually is could go out of the way there as far as the wording of it. Could be that through the Lord they were added to them, which would be a reference to Acts chapter 2, 42 and 47. But you've got different groups that are found here. And among those groups, or you have individuals that were aware of what was going on, perhaps saw what was going on, and yet they are referred to as the rest. And because of some hesitation on their part, they were unwilling to join with the disciples on that occasion. Yes, Kelly.
This is not the way I've read this in the past. And I would submit that perhaps the word join there does not have reference to being in association with, but rather has reference to counting as on equal grounds. So if we were to read it, you would equate it that they, or them, of verse 13, with all the disciples. If we say we've already had the example in the first part of the chapter 5 of the apostle, Peter in specific here, because he had authority from God. And I think it's correctly pointed out that he was given a measure of miraculous knowledge about their thoughts that he would not have otherwise had. He was able then, through the authority God gave him, to pronounce judgment on them in the sense that then God delivered discipline to them. Fear came upon the church, and then in verse 12, through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done, and they, I would submit, is the apostles, were all with one accord and solemn porch. And none of the rest dared join them, meaning they did not want to consider themselves on the same level or on the same level of authority with the apostles, but esteemed them highly. That's the way I would read that. And then it says, because if it means association, they could mean different things. If they didn't want to join them, if that's all the disciples, maybe because they were repulsed, because they thought they were practicing error, or they were contradicting the Jewish religion, rather than join them, as it seems to be indicating in verse 13, they were esteeming the apostles as having the authority from God. Not that they were above other disciples, but they recognized the authority that God had given them, and instead of joining them, that is to say, counting themselves on an equal standing with, they esteemed the apostles as those who had authority from God.
Now in that, if you take that position, verse 13, where the phrase, but the people esteemed them highly, would you have reference to the brethren? Or?
Okay, yeah.
See, that's one of the reasons why I indicated that this is a text that is somewhat difficult, because the explanation that Kelly just gave is one that is in accord with Scripture with regard to the specific statement in verse 12 that the hands of the apostles were responsible for the signs and wonders done, not the rest of the disciples. And the language there is sufficiently generic that at our side of it, at our end, it's somewhat difficult to construe as to what is under consideration there. So that is another position that is taken. My view of it is that the reason why I take the position I do is that the term that is used there, join them, that would have reference to the association, in other words, agreement or joining with the group, which is the more common use of that phrase. Kelly's position would be one that is certainly a scriptural idea or concept, but it does take that word join as a somewhat accommodated use. In other words, it's not the normal use. So again, there are several positions. So long as in this discussion we are not getting into something that a lot causes us to violate context or a principle of Scripture found elsewhere, I don't think that we can be dogmatic with regard to our understanding of it.
Let me throw just one other aspect of that. This is study, but in Acts chapter 8, you remember when Simon the sorcerer desired to have the ability to impart his hands on others as the apostles did. And of course, when Peter rebuked him, he told him, you had neither a part nor a lot in this matter. You cannot join with us in the sense that you are going to have the same ability we had. That was a specific ability God gave to a specific group of people. It's not something you can purchase.
Right. And again, there's no indication there that anyone other than the apostles were doing the miracles on that occasion. Yes, Dean.
Okay. Go back to verse 12. We have, and they were all of one accord. That they either applies to the apostles or all the people. And so you go to 13. So the rest either is going to be the apostles or all the people. And I have the same thing as Kelly did about that is the apostles that were on Solomon's porch, and the other Christians didn't dare to be on the porch with them. I had a problem with it because I took the dare and being afraid. But then, as Kelly brought out, that it was like the apostles' scheme. More or less, you know, and that makes more sense, so I don't have that problem anymore, that applied to the brethren as the apostles that were on the Solomon's porch.
Yeah, well, there are two things about that, Dick, that just make note. The word there is the correct interpretation, I mean the correct translation of that word. It has reference to individuals who would not, and again, with regard to, you mentioned fear, perhaps fear had a part in this, and again, that's the view that I've taken on it. But when you say you don't dare do it, it's the term is the same as the way we use it in the English. And that is the Greek term. I did a word study on that just yesterday. With regard to it, that is a correct interpretation. I think the King James Version reads it, they durst not, which is an old English term. But durst not, yeah. And it simply means that they did not dare to do it. It was something that they would not take part in or be a part of. My only objection that I would have to your statement there is when it says none of the rest, that would have to mean or have to be a reference to the brethren. I think that it very easily could have a reference to the people who are around them in the temple. And I don't think that there's anything that would preclude that in the context. But again, this is not something we need to be dogmatic about. Both of those views could be so, and I don't know that we can say for certain which one is true. Yes, Jeff?
It doesn't stop us from trying, right?
Well, sure. That's the purpose of study.
When it says the rest in verse 13, there are three groups that are talking about. There's the church, the apostles, and the people. And in verse 11, the people are all the verb. In verse 13, the people are the people. But I think it can be pretty surely stated that then in verse 13 is not referring to a church. Because says none of them dare join, or none of the rest dare join them, but the people esteem them highly. I think that then pastors versus apostles there was referred to the church, then verse 14 would make any sense, where it says, and the believers were increasingly added to the Lord. People were joining the saints, they were joining the church, they just weren't joining the apostles. And the stature and
okay. Don't know that I agree completely with that either, but I'll accept the statement on it. Yes, Kelly.
There, when that word is used, I have no workplace, so I'm thinking a little bit on the plot here. But remember when the man came to David and confessed him he had killed Saul. And you remember David told him before he ordered one of his officers to execute him, he said, why were you not afraid to put your hand to the Lord's one? In other words, how did you dare, and again, I haven't done word study, I'm not sure if it's the same word, equivalent to Hebrew with what's used here in Greek, but how were you, why was it you were not afraid to put your hand to the Lord's one, even though he asked you to do it? And without doing work study, I would say perhaps the same concept is being used here. They were afraid. They did not dare. They did not presume to acquaint themselves on the same level as the apostles and the authority that you give. That's it.
Sure. And again, legitimate. Yeah, legitimate. Yes, Dennis.
Just a couple observations. First of all, there in verse 12, the natural antecedent for they is the apostles. There is Mark. Verse. Go back to before this verse, you really can't find another one. Another interesting observation is that Luke has used this exact phrase twice already in reference to the apostles alone in 1:14 and in 2:1. And in 1:14, he does mention the women and Jesus' mother and has them too. So it seems to be an indication there that it might be talking about just the apostles. Another scenario could very well be coming on the heels, because what happened in the first part of chapter 5 was the beginning of a great activity amongst the apostles in performing these signs and wonders. Something hadn't been done before. And verse 11 speaks of the great fear that came upon the church. I can see the church seeing all this is going on to draw back a little bit from the apostles because of this great esteem they have for them. Also, I can see Solomon's porch as being the apostles' center of operations. That's their office, so to speak. That's where they were all together in one accord and doing their work. So those who hear the preaching would come to them there to hear it. But to say that the church as a whole might meet there at one place, we've got many, many thousands by now that are members. This would at least be a subset of the church.
Well, temple's a big place, and you're right. Not all of them would be there all the time and such. But right. I understand that. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on beyond that and look at some other things. Let me see. I want to look up there, and my notes are down here. Let's see here. Okay, the other thing that we want to make note of is the continuation of the conversions. You'll notice in verse 14, we are told that believers were increasingly added to the Lord, multitudes of both the men and women. So where up to this point in time, there have been actually two things that were said. First, the 3,000 that were mentioned on the day of Pentecost. And there was a mention in the latter part of that section as Lord added to the church daily such as were being saved. Then as we continued on into the third chapter, you'll remember that there were, after that period of time, at that point in time, 5,000 men who had been converted, and that is besides the women that might be that would be the addition to that. So here we find simply that there were increasingly added to the Lord multitudes. So this was a wonderful time of growth in the first century, and I think the language that we're using in this section of our study is one that is or a language that is significant in that you find a newness that is here that was bringing this awe and this fear and this amazement, the wonders that we mentioned before at this point in time. So a tremendous amount of good was being done in response to the gospel message. There's something to be said for newness. There is something to be said for the fact that this was the fullness of times and the hearts of men were ready to receive the preaching of the truth. But as was mentioned by Kelly a bit earlier, we're talking here about the preaching of the resurrection. I want you to note that at least in part, as we get into the study of verses 17 and following, this statement concerning these individuals that were withstanding them, the Sanhedrin and such, as much as they were disturbed about the miracles and the fact that it says there that they were filled with indignation, verse 17, latter part. And the term indignation there is the Greek word zealous, which has reference to jealousy. That they were jealous about what was going on. They were disturbed about the preaching that was done. The apostles were preaching the resurrection of Jesus. And that message was what was bringing about the conversions of these individuals. As Kelly alluded to, it's the word, the preaching of truth. Faith comes by hearing. Hearing by the word of God, as the writer in Romans 10:17 indicates. And that was disturbing to them. And so this message was new. The message was powerful. And a great deal of good was coming as a result of that. So that statement of conversion in verse 14 is one that's very similar to those that have been found previously and indicating that good work of converting souls to Christ was continuing on this occasion. Now in verses 15 and 16, as a result of this, there were many who were infirm in one way or another that were being brought to the apostles, and it is specifically mentioned that they laid them in beds and couches that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might fall on some of them. And so there is a specific mention of Peter. And I think obviously as you look at the early record of the apostles' work, that Peter had a preeminent role. He had a position of influence and conspicuousness where, as we read, for example, in the previous chapter, in Acts chapter 4, he and John had been the ones responsible for the healing of the lame man, and as a result, they were the first two who were imprisoned or brought before the Sanhedrin because of the things that they had done. And you'll remember even there that the address that was given, though we cannot assume from that that John did not speak, because I think the indication is that he did, that it is Peter's address that is given the place of prominence in the narrative. And so here again, we find a situation to where Peter, who was one of the most outgoing and headstrong and assertive of the disciples, as we see in the ministry of Jesus through his life, the interaction that Peter had with him and with others, and that kind of conspicuousness, that kind of preeminence was present here as well. It's a far cry. You see, these kinds of verses are taken by the Catholics to assert that his being the bishop, the preeminent one, the chief of the apostles, and as such the vicar of Christ on earth and the forerunner of the popes. And there's nothing in this that can be construed in that way. It is simply, in fact, I'm trying to remember, and it just exactly where it is. Someone perhaps can help me, but you remember when the people sought with regard to the preaching of Peter, of Paul and Barnabas, and Barnabas was Zeus and Paul was Hermes, because he was the spokesman. Individuals obviously would make reference. I could find it real quick if I could turn and talk at the same time, but I can't. But you find in that situation where Paul was the one that did the speaking. Now the because of that the pagans interpreted in a particular way because he was the spokesman. And it's obvious that his individual saw that Peter had a preeminent place, and that's all I think that we can construe from that is the fact that he had a place of preeminence among the apostles, and that people saw him and reacted to him. So as a result of that, and this is the significance of it in verses 15 and 16, that people were brought into the streets, laid on beds and couches so that they might be healed. And there are two specific things that are mentioned. You notice in verse 16 of the text. They brought sick people, and they brought those who were tormented by unclean spirits, and they were all healed. And the reason I wanted to emphasize that is because when you talk to the charismatics today, you talk to them about illness, there are some, and not all of them feel this way, but there are some who will take the position that all illness is caused by demons, demon possession, unclean spirits. And they will attribute, in fact, you'll hear individuals that will say, we have to exercise, or we have to expunge from ourselves the spirit of anxiety, or the spirit of doubt, or the demon of anger, and they will attribute both negative emotions, temptations, sins, as well as actual physical illness with demon possession. And in order to heal individuals, they claim that of necessity individuals must have these demons or these unclean spirits exorcised from them. And it's a very common thing that you see in our day. And so there is a confusion of demon possession or the possession of individuals by unclean spirits with just what is illness. And there is a distinction that is made in this text between the two. Now, I don't know what the difference was. And I suppose that there were times, and I think, in fact, if you go to some of the examples to where it may have been, to where it wasn't obvious as to whether an individual had a demon or whether he was simply ill. But apparently there was an ability to make it to distinguish and to make an understanding as to when something was just an illness, someone was sick, and when they were actually possessed with an unclean spirit. And it is an indication, I think, that today when individuals are making these claims, that the claims themselves are false. Obviously, it is the case as you go through in all of the demonstrations and the claims that are made by charismatics today, they just do not jibe with the descriptions and the scenarios that are found in the New Testament, whether it be with regard to the performing of miracles or the ability to heal or even what was present in that first century, and that was demons and unclean spirits that actually physically possessed some at that time. And we just don't have the equivalence of that, though the charismatics are very, very strong in their attempts to correlate those things. What we see today practiced is a far cry from what was being practiced at this time. What you have here, and this is, I think, the final key that we'll give in our lesson this morning in the latter part of verse 16, is that they were all healed. When the divine is involved, there is no failure to heal. And again, that is what is different between what was practiced there on that occasion and what we find practiced often today. 100% healing, because these were divine demonstrations from God. Yes, Kelly.
Acts 14, 8 through 14 is where you're referring to Paul, Martin Luther, where the people tried to worship.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. Anybody have any other comments? All right, thank you. I'm sorry, I got thrown a little bit. That really is bothering me that the projector went out like that, because it shouldn't have. I wish that we could have a warranty, and I don't guess they supply them, but that happened a little bit more quickly than it should have. Thank you all for your kind attention. We'll pick up there next week.